John, Jeff Goodman tweeted this last week. One ref to me the other day. These days, there are two groups. Refs who suck and refs who really suck. I'm just glad I'm in the first group.
And who said that, Jeff Goodman?
So a referee told Jeff Goodman.
Oh, man. That referees suck and
refs who suck and refs who really suck.
Wow. I don't know about that. I mean, you are surprising me on that one. I think that guy probably said it in jest, but, you know, that's not something you want to tell a guy like Jeff Goodman because he's going to put it out there. But we both know it's been pretty much open season on criticizing referees. It's in my mind, Jeff, I don't want to pontificate by any means, but I'll tell you, I might be mistaken, but it seems like it's more so this year than I've seen in the past. I had 11 or 12 years as a supervisor, but it seems like there's a lot coming down on the referees criticism-wise.
They've tracked the call. It's coming from inside the house. Even the refs are criticizing.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, like, I'm not sure you caught me by surprise there.
That's how we'll kick off episode 25 of The Whistleblowers. I'm Luke Decock, News and Observer sports columnist, and with me as always, John Clockerty, the Hall of Famer. And that's just kind of the way things are going these days, is your take on that.
Yeah, you know, every morning I pick up the paper, go online and listen to some of the sports commentary, and either I just, I saw where, this is a little bit different, but I saw where Izzo is really upset at their fans for criticizing his team. So it's a frustrating time for coaches. We saw what's going on with some of the ACC coaches and their criticism of referees. But when your teams aren't as good and there's no separation, there's no elite teams, there's certainly a lot of frustration, and it's starting to come out.
Well, let's start there, because our last episode we recorded before this happened. It posted after this happened because it took me a while to get the audio sorted out. Mike Bray, after a loss at Florida State, said, "We're treated by the officials like we haven't brought football as a full member, but yet we get a full share of the ACC Network TV. Are you kidding me?" That was so. In the next day, Bray got hit with Notre Dame got hit with a $20,000 fine, and Bray was publicly reprimanded. And my takeaway from that was, you can question the quality of officiating, but you cannot question the integrity of officiating. So Mike Krzyzewski can talk about freedom of movement is not alive and well, and you can get away with that, dance on the line. But you start talking about the integrity of officiating in the ACC, and then the conference had to step in. What was your take on that whole the Bray's comments and then the fine?
Yeah, when I saw what he said, I knew that there'd be more than just a reprimand coming. If Coach Bray would have simply said, you know, I wasn't happy with the officiating tonight. I thought we might have got fouled on the last play, and which he's not supposed to do, then he would have gotten a phone call from either Paul Brazo or gotten a phone call for Brian Kersey, the supervisor, and it would have ended right there. It would have been just like, hey, Mike, let's back up on it. You know the policy regarding comments on officiating. But when Mike Brace brought the football into the picture and the things he said, he was insinuating that his team and Notre Dame's getting the short end of the officiating because they're not sharing their football revenue, pretty much. And then that simply crosses the line. That's what that $20,000. But just another to add to that, he's so frustrated when he gets up from the post game. He walks out and then he says, "Oh, come on, John Gaffney." Well, John Gaffney's the guy that gave him the technical foul, and he knows John Gaffney because they were both in the Big East together, and now John Gaffney is certainly part of the coalition, the ACC. So he took an extra step and identified a referee by name, which again puts the ACC in a position where this goes beyond just criticizing referees.
Yeah, ironically, none of the three referees in that game, that Florida State Notre Dame game, will be in Greensboro.
Right.
They're not, none of them are ACC guys. Primary guys. Tough couple of weeks for Gaffney, who was on the receiving end of Coach K's talk about freedom of movement. He worked that game at Cameron against Louisville, and then he was at the Florida State game. That's a little too much time in the crosshairs for anyone, I think.
Yeah, I like John Gaffney.
And poor Gaff.
I certainly think he's a good referee. But there's probably a lot of things that, you know, John Gaffney could be frustrated too this time of year of hearing too much from the coaches and too many complaints from the coaches. So he may be on edge, and the coaches are on edge, and everything's on the line. And, you know, going back to Coach K, freedom of movement is taking a day off. I think it's just a combination of everything. Coach K has seen John Gaffney multiple times. Mike Bray has seen John Gaffney. They know he's a good referee. Maybe they have some gripes. Maybe the game was too physical. Maybe Bray's guy did get fouled. But, you know, he didn't like where John Gaffney was positioned when he came across the floor to give him a technical. That probably was really because there was a guy much closer to Mike Bray and John Gaffney. But Gaffney reached out and got him, and then he was really it. It's a wonder he didn't get another one.
You see that happen a lot, though. That happened in the Michigan State-Penn State game the other night. The referee from across the court got Izzo, and then I think the same was true when Pat Chambers got teed up later in the game. It seems like those guys have a better view of what the coach is doing. Or like you said on our last podcast, sometimes that referee feels the duty to even things up if the other coach has already gotten one.
I don't know either one of those situations. And the other thing that's entered into, there are referees that are really good referees that work in the ACC that you have to really do something egregious as a coach to get a technical. Okay? And then there are others that if you just simply cross the line, and you might get whacked real early. And so a guy that likes to communicate more and try to get a coach settled down, he doesn't give the technical, but then another guy says, and takes care of business right away. So it could have been a situation. I refereed with guys that would never give a technical. They thought if they gave a technical, they'd never work at that place again. The coach might even say, you're done here. You're never going to work here again. I've heard that. And some of those referees are afraid to give technicals.
Scared. Wow. Back to Bray for a second. You know, the idea that Bray's feeding into here, that he's tapping into, is that ACC officials, and you see this in college football all the time, are somehow invested in the success or what's best for the league, or Swofford has a bat phone and he's, you know, checking in with the referees room at halftime. How much connection is there between an official and the conference for which he technically works? You know, if you're a guy who's worked the last 8 or 9 ACC tournaments and you're an ACC guy at that point, do you feel a connection to the league, or does that only happen like it did for you kind of when you became a supervisor and were actually a league employee?
Good question.
Because you work so many games in other leagues as well.
You work so many games in other leagues. I think referees do feel an allegiance to a league, but they don't change any of the way they referees or how they referee teams when they go outside their first priority. And now that this coalition exists, what they call a coalition, it's even more situation where referees are changing conferences all the time. And it hasn't happened yet, Luke, but there's going to be a time where the John Gaffneys and the Pat Driscolls and the Mike Stevenses are going to be refereeing maybe a day or two in the ACC. And a Roger Ayers, Mike Eads, and Ron Groover are going to be seen refereeing in the Big East.
I mean, I think we're past that point.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, we're talking about two ACC games that Gaffney worked. You know?
No, I'm talking about tournament
games. Oh, tournament games.
Tournament games. You'll see Big East referees actually spending a day or two down in the ACC, and a Roger Ayers and a Mike
Interesting.
Dean will be moved. That's what the coalition is probably going to gear to. I just think that if you're working a Roger Ayers working a large percentage of his games in the ACC, if I was the supervisor, I would say, you know, Roger, maybe the first 2 days would be better off up in the Big East. Rather than you might, if you're going to work down here, you might see that team at least twice, another team twice, where we can even this out, and it works. I think it's where we might see that before too long.
And we've seen a little of that the last couple of years, breaking away from sort of the, you know, the pyramid where the three quote unquote best guys work the title game, and the next six yes. work the semis. Now that group of nine gets mixed up. And some guys who may traditionally have worked the title game will work a semi and then go work the A-10 title game.
Oh, that's happened. You're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's happened in the last couple of years.
Yeah, sure has.
Mm-hmm. So there's some of that. I mean, just as from a layman's perspective, you know, I like the idea of the conference tournament having sort of the pool of referees. Like I understand the desire for diversity, geographic diversity. And I think, you know, mixing referees among the ACC, Big East, and the lower conferences, you know, that's, you know, within this coalition is great, because you create almost like a baseball farm system where you can have guys who are like, you can call up a guy from the A-10, or you can call up a guy from the Big South or Ivy League to the A-10. I think that is going to be really going to have really strong long-term benefits for development, because you can take a guy who is maybe just a Big South level official and get him some opportunities in controlled situations to see how he does on a bigger stage, give him feedback. You know, I think that's going to help create that pipeline that doesn't necessarily exist now, or doesn't exist to the degree that it should in the future. But I do like the conference tournaments having that. You know, in the old days, yeah, you had those 12 or 13 guys person. and you knew what you were getting into, and over the course of the year you knew those guys. Well, you probably knew 10 or 11 of them would be in Greensboro, and it was kind of up to people like you who the 12th and 13th guys were. But I always thought that, you know, especially at a time when expansion is diluted and changed the character of these conferences, I thought that that was always something that kept things – it was a little bit of traditionalism that kept things in order and felt right. Maybe those times have changed. Maybe that's past.
I think the referees would like to be permanent in the ACC tournament rather than make the crossover both ways. I'm not sure John Gaffney or Pat Driscoll want to come down here, but as a supervisor and a Paul Brazzo and I'm trying to think of the Big East guy.
Johnny Kell.
Stu Jackson. They probably sit around and say, you know what, we can give these referees some relief rather than have them down there for four games in the ACC. Maybe we can put them up here for one game and they down the ACC. So I think there's a good argument for both. But I would think that the coaches would want a permanent – the ACC guys that work the majority of their games to work their ACC tournament, and the Big East also. They're familiar with them. They're comfortable with them. But I think – that it's a possibility we may see, since they cross over during the year so much, then they could do it also. One thing about Coach Bray's comments, I don't know if I'm just the only guy that is thinking this way, Luke, but when he said about, because we don't bring football into the equation, that conversation back at Notre Dame with administrators or something, that just didn't blurt out. That has had, in my opinion, that has been must have been part of the discussions multiple times.
Not a coincidence he's bringing that up.
Yeah, that he's bringing that up. That's not something that has had conversation before. Now, nobody's heard that before that we're aware of, but for him to bring that out, that we're not getting treated officiating wise, because we're not bringing football in. And I thought, ooh, is that what they're thinking up there? You know, because we'd love to have them in football, but
yeah, it's funny. I won't, you know, I think not that I'm responsible in any way for this, but I've written and others have written referring to Notre Dame and the ACC as a sort of half pregnant arrangement mm-hmm. with Notre Dame. You know, are they in or are they out? You know, is Notre Dame an ACC school or not? And obviously they won an ACC title in basketball, and Mike Bray's as ACC as they get back when Maryland was in the league. But still,
yeah, you know, when he was an assistant at Duke.
Right, but he grew up an ACC guy.
Sure,
you know,
right.
He grew up watching Lefty, and mm-hmm. when he won the title in Greensboro, you know, it was a thrill for him not just to win an ACC title, but to do it in North Carolina. He, more than anybody, appreciated what that meant. So it's an interesting question. You know, has he been listening to those of us? And again, I'm not taking credit or blame or anything, far from the only one, but it is a bit of an outside narrative joking about Notre Dame and its relationship to the league. And I wonder if that's kind of, as you said, percolated within the halls of the campus in South Bend.
That's a good way to put it. And I think when I heard him say that, I thought, well, that's been part of the conversation before we heard this. But, you know, Luke, you may know. I don't know if the Big Ten turned them down because they wouldn't come football, whether they ever entertained going to the Big Ten. But Delaney, I don't think, would have taken them without their football.
No, it's a crazy kind of operation, the Notre Dame football thing, and probably too big for the scope of this podcast to get into. I do believe at some point Notre Dame is going to get left out of the college football playoff. And I think that's the point where football independence becomes less valuable to Notre Dame than conference membership. We're not there yet. It hasn't happened yet. The circumstances haven't been there. I think that someday will be the tipping point. And if the CFP expands to 8, it may never happen. But at some point, I think you're going to have an 11-1 Notre Dame team that gets left out when, if it was in the ACC, it would have a chance to play another team in a conference game and be a conference
champion. Then yeah. You win the conference championship, right?
We'll see. We'll see. Different subject. Had you in your career, I know you held back plenty of coaches from other referees or other coaches. Did you ever have to hold back a coach from going after his own fans?
No.
That's what we saw at Duke last week.
Oh, that was bizarre.
When Mike Krzyzewski was angry about the Jeff Capel chant, and Mike Eads actually had to hold the coach back from screaming, stepping on the court to scream at his own fans. He actually could have gotten teed up for screaming at his own fans because he was out on the court, which is crazy when you think about it.
But then when time ran out, didn't he go across the floor and continue?
Yeah, so what happened is...
He looked so mad.
He was very angry. What happened? So the Cameron craze, Jeff Capel, the first former player back in Cameron coaching a team. So emotional night, and you know later on Coach K would say... It was their first game after Kobe Bryant had passed away. He was emotional about that. But the Cameron Crazies did their standard, and this has been part of the repertoire for years, the Jeff Capel sit with us chant. And we've all heard it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Mike Krzyzewski's heard it. But just hearing Jeff Capel's name, and Krzyzewski went ballistic. And he's screaming, shut up, shut up. And then after the half ended, he went walked straight across the court and was screaming, you know, he's one of us, to these stone-faced students who, ironically, were trying to honor Jeff Capel for being one of them.
Right, right, right.
And they're getting yelled at for it. I think if you're going to be that angry and that unhinged, which, you know, he was almost out of control, you need to be right.
Yeah, I saw how he was so angry and the contortions on his face and how red his face was, and I'm thinking, man, and not only that, I looked at the students and they were like, oh my gosh, you know, they were sick. But I got another take on that a little bit. During that time, Luke, Kobe had died helicopter crash. He was very close to Kobe, and I think that certainly was hanging over him. And then there's a case in New York where Avenatti, a guy that tried to extort money from Nike, says on record that he has Nike paying players, and one of those players were the family of Zion. So we've got these two things there, and maybe something else. Maybe I'm missing something.
You know, John, I do want to step in. I may have this wrong. I think the only documented payments that they talked about in the trial were to DeAndre Ayton's family and some other California players. I don't think we've actually gotten to the point where
they said,
what they said was that that Nike couldn't deny that they hadn't paid players. Okay. And then there's been more evidence. I could be wrong about that, but then
I don't want to go on record saying that Avenatti says he has evidence.
Well, now what Avenatti says and what other people have said at trial are two different things. Avenatti said a million things. I'm just saying the things that have come up at trial that have been
right
semi-corroborated so far, I believe, have involved basically California and West Coast players and DeAndre Ayton, who ended up signing with Arizona and Adidas school.
Tell me if I'm wrong, Luke, because did Avenatti say that I have it on record? I mean, this is what he said, and again, it hasn't been proved. I have it on record that players were being paid, including Duke players, and if you dispute that, sue me.
That's right. I mean, he's basically, well, he was extorting Nike to not reveal this information he has about payments. Yeah, that part's out there. That could have been weighing on Mike Krzyzewski. I don't think so. I think he was emotional for all those reasons and just kind of lost it. You know, the unanswered questions are, you know, and maybe this doesn't need an answer. You know, what did he think they were saying that was so awful?
Exactly.
And the other one is, and I wrote about this in a column. You can find it on our website at newsobserver.com. Coach K has a long history of coaching the crazies. You know, there was a time in the mid-2000s where he threatened to take their seats away if they didn't, their attendance and enthusiasm wasn't stronger. And you go back to the mid-90s and the stuff you and I remember, the pizza boxes and the underwear and the condoms keys, and the keys.
Yeah.
All that stuff being thrown on the floor and chants that were, you know, much more creative than it is now, but vulgar and vile at times. You know, Kay played a big role in the mid-90s in dialing that back and sanitizing kind of the crazies. Now, the result of that, as I think he realized in the mid-2000s, was it's less spontaneous, it's less creative, it's very choreographed, it's very scheduled, it's very ritualized. But it's still, and it's been copied, it's never, you know, imitated but never equaled, it's still very loud and intimidating, in part because of the structure of the building and in part because what they do may be, you know, less creative than it used to, but it's still effective. So, and then by 2012, Krzyzewski was complimenting them and saying how much better the atmosphere was. And he had his whole Club Cameron thing. And so we've seen him over the years try to manipulate's probably too strong a word, but try to affect the behavior of the students in one way or another. He's done the same thing with the Duke Chronicle, the student paper. He's pushed and pulled them in different directions over the years, or tried to. And you know, there's times he's done the same thing with the administration of the university. You know, I think, as I wrote, he operates as if he sees the entire campus as a series of coachable entities,
right,
with mixed results, not always with success and not always with failure. But so there's a long history here of his interactions with the fans. But what really made this unusual, I think, was the sort of venom and rage,
yeah,
which you even directed against his own players, you don't always see. You see it over the course of a season in a timeout where he slams the clipboard. I mean, and you see it with officials, but it's not an every night thing. So to see that directed at students was strange. I think if I were a person on campus, I would be very concerned about a representative of the university treating students like that. You know, addressing students in that way. I think it's one thing to address a player like that. I don't think it's acceptable for an authority figure on campus to treat students like that. And then so getting all the way back to the second unanswered question is, why did he assume the worst when he heard them chanting Jeff Capel's name? Why did he automatically assume the worst? That was the other part of it to me. It was a very strange situation, but, and you know, obviously he said,
he's not going to let anything negative come toward Jeff Capel.
Well, why did he assume it was negative?
Well, that, I don't know that, but I think what got him riled up is he thought something was being directed at Jeff Capel.
Oh, yeah, no, there's no question that's what he thought.
And that was going to be something that got him really angry. But I don't know what he thought they said. I have no clue.
Your
point is, why did he think it was going to be a negative? I mean, or something.
I mean, he just assumed it was the worst thing possible.
Yeah.
So I think there's some unanswered questions there. Maybe his emotional estate accounts for some of it. But I'm surprised there wasn't more fallout on campus for
the students.
The administrators even. I guess everyone just treads lightly over there. And he apologized after the game and offered some suggestions for how the students should cheer. And then I think there may have been some realization the next day, maybe even after I called over there to ask about it, that there was more work to be done. And that's when he went out to the tents in Krzyzewskiville and spent a half hour talking to the fans.
I didn't know, is that right? Yeah.
And continuing to apologize, which I think was needed and necessary. So
I didn't know that. So he was feeling it. I think so. In an area that I shouldn't have.
Yeah, so the realization that more apology was needed, I think, is probably enough to put an end to this in the larger scheme of things. But it was an odd scene. And that brings us back to my original question for you, which was, you'd never held back a coach from going after his own fans.
No. I can't remember, Luke, even if it was like one individual that was harassing. I think there was a situation where actually it was Memphis in Temple, and John Chaney was getting angry at, they had placed Memphis fans right behind the Temple bench, which was purposeful but wrong. And Chaney couldn't communicate with his team. Temple had a good team at that time, an outstanding team. And they went into Memphis, and they could beat Memphis on the road. I remember this, and Chaney, I could see he was getting so worked up that he came close to having an exchange with these students who were reaching over the rail and yelling at Temple. And I went to Coach Chaney and says, Coach, I will allow you to take your team as far out on the floor during a timeout as you want. Let's get out there 10 feet, 15 feet. I says, you won't have to listen to those fans. They'll be away from you. And I says, and you know what? He never said thank you. He never says good idea. He just simply did it. He says, okay. And then he went and did that. And that's all that. Had he stayed there, Luke? We may have had, because Chaney is the kind of guy that could only take so much, and then he was going to act on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's tie everything we've been talking about together. We talked in the last podcast about Krzyzewski's comments about Louisville and how physical that game was. So Louisville comes to NC State. And J.D. Collins, the national supervisor of officials, is sitting in the front row at PNC Arena. And what do you think happens in that game, John? Don't answer.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
Louisville, who Mike Krzyzewski accused of being getting away with too much physically, was called for 10 fouls. NC State was in the double bonus halfway through the first half.
Okay.
10 fouls in 11 minutes. It's funny how that works.
Well, okay. So your take is that Mike Krzyzewski sent a message out there that Louisville was too physical and played too physical. So when they go to NC State, the message had gotten down that Louisville's too physical and there was fouls called immediately.
I mean, I'm not saying that it happened that explicitly. No,
I have
I think
another take on it.
There's a it's out there in the zeitgeist.
I have another take.
Okay.
The national coordinator is J.D. Collins. He was not at the Louisville-Duke game.
Correct.
Okay. But he shows up at the Louisville-NC State game.
Right.
Which in my mind, had far more influence on the way the game was called, close or by the rules. That would have happened whether it was Louisville or anybody else. That game was going to be refereed because the national coordinator, that's not saying it was right, the national coordinator was there, and it wasn't a message from Mike Krzyzewski. It was a message from J.D. Collins that we're going down the stretch now, and I need to see the points of emphasis implemented the way we talked about them at our October clinics. And I don't even know who the referees were, but I watched the game. And I watched referees that will referee a game, those same referees in the Atlantic 10, maybe the night before, that didn't referee that same way. And I would probably get chastised by my fellow officials, but I'm seeing when that national coordinator shows up, they are going to be refereeing that game the way he wants it to be refereed.
Why don't they do that all the time?
That's a great question, because there's probably a thought in their mind that I don't know why Luke, but you know, why is officials inconsistent and not consistent every night in implementing those rules? It just doesn't work that way.
So the argument that's been made elsewhere this season is officials are overwhelmed with too many points of emphasis, and most nights they pick and choose the ones that they can deal with mentally. But when J.D. Collins is in the house, they have no choice but to try to get everything.
That's a good answer, and we talked about that in the podcast, the one before the last one. We talked about that, okay? Referees have all these different points of emphasis that they have to implement and adjudicate, and maybe they'll let an arm bar go in one game, and maybe marginal illegal screen, but when that national coordinator is there, they're not going to let any arm bar goes or any hand checking or any of those. And so now Louisville's got five fouls.
Right. Right. No, I think that's fair. And I think we all operate differently when we're under close scrutiny from a supervisor or evaluator or a boss. So I don't think there's anything malign or...
Look, if I could just... I refereed 26 NCAA tournaments. And that's not... I'm not boasting about the number of times, but every NCAA tournament I worked and every NCAA game I worked, and I took a crew out there, I looked at them and said, I do not want you to referee any different than you refereed during the season. What got you here was the way you refereed during the regular season. Now, we've got three evaluators out there that are grading us out. Do not try to referee for those evaluators. Referee the game how you refereed in your conference every night, in and out, and we'll have a great game. You start refereeing because you think these evaluators are looking for certain things, the game's going to get screwed up. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Some guys were always nervous, but that's the only way to approach it. These guys should be consistent in the Louisville Duke game, the same as they were in the State Louisville game. But unfortunately, it probably wasn't the case.
Speaking of Louisville, there was a big story in the Memphis paper this week about the Louisville-Memphis, old Louisville-Memphis rivalry. that you were featured prominently in.
Look, it was probably the most bizarre situation. There's an art, if you pull up the commercial appeal, there's an article about the Louisville-Memphis rivalry. But in 1985, the last game of the regular season, I had the game, and we're into the latter parts of the game, maybe the last 5 minutes, and I called a foul against Baskerville Holmes. How about that name?
That's a great name.
Baskerville Holmes. And as I reported, a switchblade came out on the floor and landed at my feet. And it was a legitimate knife. It was it was not one of these fingernail fouls. It was a legitimate knife. I picked it up, and the mistake I made was I put it at the scorer's table. And after the game, I was told that Dana Kirk, the Memphis coach, came up and took the knife. Probably the most disappointing thing is there was a reward out for anybody that could identify the person that threw the knife. Now, Luke, I'm telling you, if you were sitting next to a person that throws a knife on the floor, you knew who it was.
Yeah.
Nobody ever came forward. And it was a businessman that put a reward out, and nobody ever came forward. But clearly the most bizarre situation. And if you have time, you can probably pull up the commercial appeal and read it. It's a good story, and it's about the rivalries between Dana Kirk worked for Denny Crum, and when they separated, there was no love lost. So the game was always a rock fight. I mean, it was hard to referee.
How many of those did you do, do you think?
Well, actually, that was in 1985. That was the last regular season game. The next game I have involving Memphis is in the semifinals of the 85 championship. So I went from the regular season final to the semifinals between them and Villanova, and now Memphis shows up, and I will tell you, there was no issue. They were quiet as church mice. they saw me, which they don't get the assignments until 1 hour before, so they see me, and they figured, you know what, we just probably need to be, and of course Villanova beat them. Villanova had a great run, but that was, I never got an apology from Dana Kirk or any, his players were never an issue.
Sure.
Dana Kirk was a tough guy to work for, but anyway, it's an interesting story.
That's funny. Other than that, what was the worst thing thrown at you during your career?
The thing, I'll go back to, rather than, it was the early 80s, it was the stuff being thrown during introductions. We know the pizza boxes, we know the condoms, we know the keys, we know that you go to Maryland and they read paper. And then as the team comes out, they roll out the paper and they throw all the paper on the floor. And it was always like, and they did that in the palestra all the time too, they would throw. But I'm sure.
Well, you can't, John, you can't honestly be lumping in Big Five streamers with these people throwing garbage on the court. Come on.
There's a little bit difference there. Yeah,
come on.
Of course.
Come on.
Of course.
And let's just say that the technical foul for throwing streamers on the court in the Big Five game is the single stupidest rule in all of college basketball.
You know, we got to the point where that was going to be, they wanted to implement that at Maryland, that when they threw the newspapers out there, if took time and had to get all the papers off, it was a technical foul. And the referee was saying, man, we can do this without a technical foul. We can get this done in a matter of seconds. Let's not start the game with a technical foul.
Anyway, please continue.
Well, that's it. You were probably one of those guys that threw the streamers at me. So that's probably what
you think. As a basketball traditionalist, you should appreciate. No, when I was there, that was during the ban.
Okay.
Yeah, we did it a couple times, I think, and both teams did. I'm trying to remember. I think LaSalle 1 year, we did it, and then they did it, and both teams deliberately missed the free throws, and then life went on as normal. But it was I get it.
Look, that is so easy. If you're prepared and you got maintenance there to get that floor cleaned off, it takes a matter of seconds to start the game with a technical foul. But so, you know, we don't need to say any more about that. I just think it's a bad thing.
So there's a lawsuit in the news this week. Three basketball officials who work sort of middle-level East Coast leagues, you knew the names a little bit, Robert Barker, Dennis Aloko, and Michael Pilla, filed a lawsuit against the NCAA accusing age discrimination, basically that they couldn't get games anymore because of their age, because the leagues they worked in, the NCAA, well, it wasn't the NCAA, but the leagues they worked in were trying to bring in younger guys. And the complaint says, quote, all three continue to receive highly favorable evaluations of their refereeing skills. However, despite continuing exemplary refereeing performance, the number of game assignments plaintiffs recently have received have declined precipitously. Barker notes, for example, this is from courthousenews.com, that he reffed 196 games between 2010 and 2016, saw that number drop to 78 from 27 to 2019, and none of the games during 2018-19 were Division I. He also notes that his assignments to Division II and Division III games have dropped precipitously. The only explanation Barker has heard from his supervisors is that he and all the older referees must make way for younger referees. Now, named as defendants in the suit are the NCAA and six conferences, A-10, Northeast, Patriot, Colonial, Ivy, and Northeast. It says Northeast 10. Is that a D2 league?
I don't know.
I don't know what that is.
But Luke, in that group, there's the A-10, Colonial, Patriot, and Ivy. All of those are under one supervisor or one group.
Right.
Okay. In addition to that, the NC. This comes from one of the lawyers that's brought the lawsuit. The NCAA have made it clear that they favor young referees, and that older, experienced referees like Barker will no longer receive the most lucrative assignments to Division I basketball games. When I read that, I was like, these lawyers obviously know what they're doing, and they reviewed before they brought the case. But number one, these officials are, I know Barker and I know Dennis Aloko. They worked for me in the Colonial. These are independent contractors. They are not employees. So when you, as an independent contractor, your contract is from year to year, and you don't owe them any assignments, whether it's a number of assignments, zero assignments, you don't owe them a contract, and you don't owe them an explanation. When I were to make my adjustments in the ACC, the Atlantic 10, or the Colonial, when I was building a staff and managing a staff, I went to our lawyers, a lawyer, on the ACC, and I asked him, how do I do this? And he said, John, you don't do anything. Say nothing, do nothing. They received a contract for 2015. Does make you obligated to give them a contract for 2016? No matter how many games they did, no matter how well they did, you don't owe them a contract. You don't owe them an explanation. You don't owe them any number of assignments, even if they refereed the ACC tournament. If you don't want to offer them a contract, they're independent contractors. And I don't know how they can feel like they can benefit from this suit. You can't discriminate against age, but those supervisors, and I don't know how the NCAA gets in.
No, that was
they don't even make assignments.
We were going to get to that in a second.
But if the league decides we don't, I'm not going to tell you the guys that I hired and fired. But I let guys go that I thought were not good for my staff. There were Final Four referees that I says, I don't need you anymore. And they called me up and said, I didn't see my contract. And I says, that's because we're not sending you a contract. And then my lawyer said, don't tell him why you're not sending it. Don't tell him that he's a pain in the backside and not good for the staff. You're not getting a contract. So this Dennis Sulaco and Bob Barker, who I know, were very average referees. And if Brian Kersey or John Cal feel like maybe we can get younger guys into those spots that have promise, maybe that's our objective. But they don't have to tell Barker and them that. They don't know anything.
The fact that the lawsuit includes the NCAA as a defendant, as the primary defendant, is curious to me because there's literally no connection between what they're complaining about and the NCAA. I guess you could maybe make the argument that the NCAA has urged conferences to hire younger officials, but the reality is the only time the NCAA has anything to do with officiating assignments is the tournament.
Correct.
So I don't know. You know, it's an interesting point that they would that they would get to the point where they feel like they would file a lawsuit over this. But to me, that's also part of being an independent contractor. If I want to change the guy who paints my house, I don't need to come up with a reason for it necessarily. I don't know.
No, I'm
sympathetic to their plight, I should say. Like, I get where they're coming from. I just don't know that in that profession, under those circumstances,
right,
that you have grounds for remedy. I don't know. This is a weird one, but the inclusion of the NCAA is worrisome in the sense that it suggests the lawyers may not have the greatest idea what they're dealing with here.
You know, here's the other thing that came out and jumped out at me in the same article. The discrimination is also coming at a time when the NCAA has been discussing making a small group of referees employees. Now, that's the first I heard that the NCAA is discussing making a small group of referees employees.
No, I see.
I've never seen that before.
You haven't heard anything about that?
Nothing. Zero.
Okay.
Zero. But I don't know where they came up. But certainly, you know, like you said, you're sympathetic. These guys probably got good evaluations. I had Dennis Sulaco. I never had an issue with any of the games that he refereed. So I think he was an average referee. But if Brian Kersey wants to let him go and give us or give him less games, and make sure that some other guys, younger guys, I mean, that just doesn't seem like that falls under discrimination.
You could make the argument, and if I don't think this would ever make it to trial, but if it did, you could make the argument that those lower level leagues from the A-10 on down are essentially developmental leagues. And this would be like a minor league baseball player filing an age discrimination lawsuit because his contract wasn't renewed because they want to bring up a prospect from AA.
Good analogy.
These guys may have graded out well, but they were never going to advance, that this was the highest level they were going to get to. And they needed to give A-10 and other league time to younger referees to see if they could develop into ACC or Big East referees. The interesting question there is, if these were good referees, it seems to me like if they weren't getting games in the A-10 or Ivy League or whatever, that given the lack of the concern generally nationally over the state of college basketball officiating, that competent referees shouldn't have trouble getting games.
Yeah.
They may have trouble getting games in the, you know, bigger conferences.
Well, the other thing, you know, there's been a change in supervisor. Maybe Reggie Greenwood, who was doing the Patriot and Ivy League, liked those guys and gave them games and really thought they were Cracker Jacks. That was Reggie Greenwood. He was assigning the games. But now you got a different supervisor who sees see them through a different eyes and say, yeah, you know, they're not that good. And so they get less assignments. The whole thing seems to be like not a very good case to me. But then the lawyers took it under. Maybe they know something I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see. Interesting point you make about the Ivy League. The Ivy League is changing its schedule starting next year, where they're going to play fewer Friday, Saturday back-to-backs. And the one thing about the Ivy League was you knew you were getting good refs on Fridays because there weren't any other games anywhere. Now that they're going to be playing some Friday, Sunday and Thursday, Saturday stuff, or I don't think Thursday, Saturday, but now that they're breaking some of that up and may not play as many Friday, Saturday doubleheaders, it'll be interesting to see what happens to officiating in the Ivy League. Although it's, I assume, and I haven't looked closely, it's changed a lot since they broke away, you know, since they joined the coalition and now have access to presumably a larger pool of officials. Anything you want to add?
Before we close it up?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to add just one thing. You go to a number of games. I watch a number of games. Of course, you know, Tim referees, and so I try to watch his games. But if it's 9 o'clock, I never get to watch his games. But I see some bad play on last possessions in close games where a coach will call a timeout, design a play, and it's not just one game, two games, three games, but there's multiple games where they take the floor, and I say to myself, that had got to be the worst execution on a last possession. That can't be what the coach has designed for this play. And I'll just bring one up last night. Butler Villanova was a nice game. And Butler has the last possession. There's a timeout. And I says, 13 seconds. They got plenty of time to run a couple sets, see if they can get something. And I thought, well, this is my thinking, they're going to take it and drive it hard, maybe get to the line or maybe get a high percentage shot. One guy dribbled all the way around the perimeter and took a three-point shot that I thought, oh, my God, what a bad shot. And it went in, and Butler beat Villanova. But that can't be the play that they designed.
But, John, wasn't it totally worth it for Gus and Raftery calling that? wasn't it worth it just for that?
Yeah, well, I can listen to referee all night long. He's the best.
Gus screaming, it was great. Yeah. And you know, the UNC Florida State game.
Yeah.
You know, they have Cole Anthony, but the whatever play they had just kind of broke down and things stalled. I've seen it too. I mean, I think it's part of, you know, the general issues with college basketball this year. You don't have the Buddy Hields or guys like that who are, you know, who can win a game by themselves at the last minute. Cole Anthony, theoretically, is a guy like that, but for whatever reason, it didn't work there. And I don't know that he's quite the same player he was for that Notre Dame game where he was just couldn't miss. I don't think you have that sort of talent. I do think one thing I've seen, and I'm sure coaches would disagree with me on this, and that's fine. I'm probably wrong. I feel like a lot of teams start their end of game action too late, that they let the clock tick down until you can only really get one shot off, as opposed to, like you said, run a couple sets and see if you get a shot. You know, they're afraid of shooting too early and instead end up rushing at the end. I feel like we've seen more of that this year, and maybe that's a talent thing too, or that could just be observer bias. But I feel like those actions come a little late. And maybe they've always been that way, and I'm just noticing it because teams are missing more. But it seems like it's become accepted, or it's become conventional wisdom among coaches, that you start with 9 or 10 seconds left.
There's a lot of that. That's your. If the score is tied, Luke, then I'm taking the last shot, and I might run that down and take it where if I miss the other, if the score is tied and the other team has no possession, I'm going to take it down, shoot it with 3 or 4 seconds, and if I miss, hopefully we can get a tap in or something like that if the score is tied. If I am down by a point, then I'm trying to make a play that if I miss it, maybe we foul with 4 seconds. So there's a lot of things that go in. But just the fact that they're not, you know, NC State had one 2 weeks ago that they had a play on the sideline. I don't know if the guy was fouled or not. I think Kevin obviously thought his guy was fouled. That's not the point. Point was they don't have any time left, and it seems like they got confused and got a bunch of guys together, and the Georgia Tech guy steals the ball, and you're saying put the ball at the top of the perimeter, and this is me, and I'm not, but I'm thinking, you know, and try to get something going. It just doesn't seem like so many cases, bad execution with one possession left in the game. That's you know.
From a referee's perspective, though, isn't it nice that some of these teams aren't putting it in the referee's hands?
Yeah. No, I'll tell you, there's nobody complaining about that guy taking that shot at Butler. thank God it went in. Let's go. You know,
on the other hand, what about the foul in the UNC game?
Yeah, I didn't like the foul. I told you the next day that I thought that. The kid that shot the ball did not go up straight up and down. He shot the ball and went forward. And when he went forward, I thought that the kid from Carolina did not hit him. Did not. I don't think there's much. I don't think the foul was called on the shot on the hand. There might have been a touch, but did not like that play. I did. There was a good referee on the play. Maybe he got suckered in.
This is just to backtrack. This is the UNC Boston, the last shot of the UNC Boston College game.
Yeah. You know, I wasn't sure exactly how the play went down until I had a replay on it. Then I looked at it, it multiple times, and I said, man, I don't see how we can get a foul on that play.
Let me ask you a technical question. So in this case, the Boston College player attempts a three-pointer. He has the right to his landing spot. In this case, he lands on the other side of the three-point line.
He moved forward. That's correct.
Is he still entitled to that space?
No. The defender's entitled to that space. Defender's allowed to go up and come down. If he comes forward... Now, here's what there's a point of emphasis, and this may have gotten the referee a little bit. One of the point of emphasis is, and it came from the NBA, when these guys were shooting jump shots from behind the line, guys were getting their feet up underneath them, and when the guy that shot the jump shot comes down on the guy's ankles. And there was a really good player a few years ago, lost playoff games because he got his leg twisted up.
So this is undercutting the offensive player.
Here's a foul. Virginia, Texas Tech. The kid from Virginia shoots a three-pointer from the corner. That kid from Texas Tech moved up underneath him.
Yeah.
And that's the foul. That's not what happened on this play.
Right.
Okay. But we all make mistakes, and I think Roy... handled it. I read where maybe it was the next day that, listen, we made plenty of mistakes. We had some possessions that we didn't do anything with. We missed shots. We made missed free throws.
Yeah, a bunch of them late. Yeah.
So it shouldn't have happened. I mean, that shouldn't have been the critical.
Well, and the reality is, with the exception of, say, overtime in a national championship game, there's very few foul calls that are the reason a team lost. I mean, there's almost always, you know, there's a reason. Failure has many fathers.
Sure.
To flip the saying around. So, yeah, North Carolina had a million chances to put that game away, and it comes down to I always say this. This is something I used to say in hockey all the time, where it's, you know, there's much less diversity in score. A one-goal game can be a lopsided game. You can be dominating and only be up a goal. But if you put, if you don't have a two- or three-goal lead and you put your fate in the hands of the officials, you lose control. Good teams don't complain about the officiating because they're up two goals, so a bad call doesn't hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, you know, in the UNC situation, UNC should have been up 5 or 6 points. Then that call doesn't hurt them. And like anything, it's a chain of failures that leads to catastrophe.
That's a great point. And I think actually in the Mike Bray thing, Mike Bray was up in that game and had a chance to win, and it got away from him, and he was frustrated and had to say something about the officiating. The next time we do our podcast, let's talk about, because you've written some things about the ACC and the number of NCAA teams that they are likely to get and the number that they may not get. And I just went online this morning, and it seems like the long shot could be Virginia with three, Louisville, Florida State, and Duke. And the long shot might be Virginia. They need to get some wins. But it blows my mind that the ACC may only get three or four teams.
Man, the ACC only deserves three teams, John. Mm. I mean, that's, you can't put it in any plainer point, plainer type than that. It's a bad year for the ACC, and I mean, I don't know that I look at Virginia and see that as an NCAA tournament team.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. But we, yes, we have UNC Duke on Saturday. Something always happens there. And anyone questions, LDecock, LDECOCK at newsobserver.com, at Luke Decock on Twitter. And we'll pick up there next time.
Perfect.
Thanks, John. Thanks for listening, everyone.